listening to the Human Growth Foundation's Endocrine Education Podcast, where healthcare providers and caregivers take a deeper dive into growth and bone disorders, as well as growth hormone deficiency treatment options with our special guest experts.
I'm Dr. Joel Steelman. I'm with the Human Growth Foundation, and I'm pleased today to be joined by Dr. Erica Oikster. Dr. Oikster is a pediatric endocrinologist who is at Raleigh Children's Hospital. She is a national, international expert in the field of precocious puberty. So thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
For the benefit of people in primary care that are listening, tell me a little bit about the kind of the most common form of precocious or early puberty that you see.
Yeah, so there are some, we think of them as variations of normal development. And I would say those are the most common. And in particular, there's a condition that we call premature adrenarche, which results in the early development of body hair, such as pubic and axillary hair, and adult body odor in young girls and boys, typically around the age of six. And that is extremely common. Some days I will see two or three new patients who have that condition. So that is not a disease. There's no treatment. It really is a variation of normal development. But there are some health consequences later on in life that we need to make families aware of.
Okay. And when you talk to families, many families come to me, and I'm sure they come to their primary care doctors with some concerns. What do you find is areas in which, like, if a family is concerned and contemplating going to see their primary care doctor, or for the help of, say, a primary care person who's earlier in their career and may not have experience, what are some of the concerning features or red flags that families or primary care doctors should look for that would say, yes, this is a child that needs to be seen sooner and investigated more thoroughly?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. I think, for moms, the biggest concern always is whether or not their daughter is about to start her period. Mm-hmm. So the important thing is that if a child has pubic hair, that does not necessarily mean that they're in actual puberty. But if a little girl has breast development outside of the toddler age range, so say, 4, 5, 6 years old, that is definitely worrisome and needs to be evaluated. And similarly, if a little boy develops enlargement of the penis and rapid growth, those are the sorts of symptoms that really should be seen.
You mentioned, and that very good points, but you mentioned briefly during our talk about infancy. So can you comment briefly about, breast tissue, particularly in baby girls during the first, 1 or 2 years of life?
Yeah, this is another variation of normal development. It's called premature thelarche. It's really fascinating. It's something that's been around forever, is not entirely well understood, but it is considered 100% benign. Now, this is something that only happens in little girls, however. So breast development in a boy is always abnormal, except during puberty, when the vast majority of boys have a little bit of what we call onchomastia. But for the toddlers, in little girls, this is almost always a very benign entity, although we do follow these girls because a very small subset of them do go on into full-blown puberty, but that's extremely rare. But again, this is something that only occurs in girls, and there are no other signs of puberty, just breast enlargement, but normal growth. And experienced pediatricians are well aware of this entity and often don't even feel the need to refer, which is perfectly fine.
Definitely. What about when families come to you, and of course there's a lot of concerns, what are some of the key messages that you tell them as you're getting prepared, you know, to investigate their child's early puberty?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important things is to reassure families that there's not something that they have done or not done to cause a child to have signs of early puberty. In particular, there's a lot of concern about environmental things like pesticides or whether there are hormones in food or milk. And I always reassure families that, you know, at least as far as we know, these are not things that are truly causing early puberty. Although if they can afford to eat organic, of course, that's always preferable. And then I always reassure families that, you know, we will get to the bottom of it. We will figure out what's going on. We will be able to tell them what the diagnosis is, and that sometimes it does take time, but growth and development are by definition slow moving processes. So there's nothing, you know, it's not an emergency if it takes a little while to make the diagnosis, and that we will be able to offer treatment when treatment is indicated.
Okay. And tell me a little bit, or talk a little bit in general terms about the typical treatment. And I guess also the discussion you have with families as far as, you know, if treatment is necessary, when they ask, you know, does this treatment need to be done?
Yes, exactly. So for the common variations of normal, there is no treatment. For central precocious puberty, which is the most common form of, you know, pathologic early puberty, we have very safe and effective treatment in the form of a GnRH analog. However, we also know that, you know, the main goal of treatment for central precocious puberty is to preserve height and allow these children to avoid the potential compromise in adult height that can occur. However, there is a lot of literature that indicates that we really cannot increase height by stopping puberty in girls who are age 8 or older. So that is one subset of patients that really probably do not need to be treated. They don't necessarily benefit. In fact, some of them may end up shorter from treatment. This is upsetting for families because some of these girls have already started their period. But I think we also can reassure families that if they are very calm and matter of fact about these developmental changes, that these early maturing girls tend to all be very mature for their age and are often able to handle this really without any significant difficulty.
And I agree with you. I think I have some situations where I have children that are, you know, precocious to on the early cusp of development. And oftentimes there's a family history, which of course speaks to the question of genetics. So talk a little bit about how genetics, you know, in very broad terms, how genetics impacts puberty.
Yeah. So of course we know that developmental timing tends to run in families. Sometimes people quote, I think, studies that have shown that girls usually achieve menarche within about a year of when their moms did. That doesn't always hold true, but that's often the case. And then things like, you know, late puberty strongly runs in families as well. But we've known about these genetic sort of tendencies, but also knowing that there are many, many, many different genes involved. But one of the really fascinating things that has emerged over the last decade or so is the discovery of 4 specific genes that when there's mutation in these genes, it can lead to central precocious puberty. And 2 of these in particular are passed only through the paternal side. So if you get a history of female relatives on dad's side, having precocious puberty, it's very possible that there may be one of these genes, the most common of which is called MKRN3. And that we know now accounts for something like 40% of familial cases of central precocious puberty. So really, really fascinating discovery.
And I agree with you. I think that genetics and what we're learning from genetics really informs us. How are you using genetics currently in your practice as far as informing and talking to families about options of treatment and just sort of outlook and prognosis?
Yeah, so it is possible to test for these genetic mutations, but honestly, it's very expensive. And these are not always commercially available. And so I am not performing genetic testing in children with central precocious puberty, but I certainly do talk with families about the fact that it's likely not a coincidence if mom had menarche at 9 or 10, and now her daughter is coming in with similar developmental timing. And then on the side of peripheral precocious puberty, we do have some genetic causes which would indicate the need for specific molecular genetic analysis in some of those children.
Right. And certainly in that particular scenario, it's much more challenging as far as managing and monitoring. Would you agree?
Yes. And those conditions are so complicated, and there's still many that we don't entirely understand. So yes, absolutely.
Well, I want to give you plenty of time to prepare and, of course, enjoy. I hope the weather in Orlando is nice today.
Oh, it's lovely. Thank you.
That's good. I'm envious here in North Texas. I had just two other things I wanted to ask you about. So, again, if you had to sort of offer sort of a recap or a summary as far as the concerns that families and primary care bring to you as far as precocious puberty, what would you say, or maybe one or two key points that in terms of just looking at the whole overview of precocious puberty?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, there are many different forms of early puberty. Not all of them are worrisome in terms of a child's future health and growth. And that we have, you know, well-established diagnostic testing and treatment options, and that we can definitely set families' minds at rest by, you know, finding out exactly what is going on and giving them prognostic information, which we have in abundance.